Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Now though, world leaders met at the Swiss mountaintop resort of Bergenstock at the weekend to discuss ways of ending the war in Ukraine. US Vice President Kamala Harris, French President Emmanuel Macron and the leaders of Germany, Italy, Britain, Canada and Japan all attended. Russia was excluded from the event and its key supporter China did not attend despite months of lobbying by Vladimir Zelensky. Well, for more on this, I'm joined by Patrick Bury, defence and security expert at the University of Bath. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Claire.
Now, Switzerland did want the summit to pave the way for a future peace process in which Russia takes part. And President Zelensky presented this 10-point plan for peace. So what was in that plan? Who signed up to it? Where might it go?
Yeah, Claire, so the plan itself is actually old. It came out in December 2022 during, obviously, once Ukraine had repelled the first part of the Russian invasion. And the 10 points, I mean, the most important are basically the recognition of Ukrainian territorial integrity, i.e. that the borders pre-February 2022 are the correct borders, and indeed including Crimea, which was taken back in 2014-15. So that's the main one. The other important ones are a cessation of all hostilities. But what this conference was actually focused on was more the low-hanging fruit, where he could get the most consensus from the most amount of nations. And so he was looking at essentially signing up to support nuclear safety, especially around the Zaporizhia power plant and other nuclear power plants which have been hit by the Russians. Food security, so exports of Ukrainian grain, and the return of prisoners and abductees or detainees from Russia which have been taken during the war. So he was able to get about 80 nations to sign up to that. Some attended but didn't sign up, like Saudi Arabia, for example, and others just sent observers like Brazil. So okay. I think it's the early part of getting some consensus going. He'll probably be happy enough with the amount of nations which have signed up to that. But the harder part will be looking about territorial integrity and cessation of hostilities down the line.
On the financial side then as well, he got this 10-year security pact with Joe Biden, EU help there as well for this $50 billion loan. How significant is that? Because it's a lot less than Vladimir Zelensky had wanted.
Yeah, there's two things. So basically the G7 and the EU have allowed the interest, which is about $3 billion, on the $325 billion of Russian seized assets, that interest to go to Ukraine, not the actual seized assets, because that would be a new precedent in international law. They don't want to break that one. So they're allowing them to take that $3 billion and use that $3 billion interest to service a loan on a $50 billion loan from the markets. So it's basically giving Ukraine the ability to enter the international markets and draw down money. I don't even know if Ukraine will end up spending or paying back that $50 billion. We'll have to see. But it's giving them access. Now, that will take at least a few months to come into action. And it's expected that about 90% of that $50 billion will be spent on running their war. An interesting point here is it's costing Ukraine about $300 million a day to run the war. It's costing the Russians about $500 million.
Mm-hmm. And the security pact had something else in there as well, because the Americans went a little further, didn't they, than perhaps might have been expected?
Yeah, they went further than I expected. Anyway, the bits you would have expected was an agreement in principle for Ukraine to join NATO when the war is over, and a long-term commitment. The agreement was out for 10 years. It's not legally binding, so like Trump could get in and he'd have to give 6 months' notice for the agreement to actually end, but he could probably start winding it down in even within that 6 months. But it's trying to basically set out to make it more difficult for him to do that. The things that were surprising were it commits the US to supply squadrons of modern jets, not just F-16s. I wasn't expecting that. It's going to give the Ukrainians more Patriot missile systems. These are really important because the Russians are now using glide bombs, which are very difficult to intercept in a cost-effective way to destroy the Ukrainian energy infrastructure, and therefore slow down their war economy and break the... test the morale even further of their civilians. So more Patriot systems and tying in the US for long-term defence industrial cooperation and intelligence cooperation, etc. So it actually went further than I was expecting in terms of those squadrons of jets and the more Patriot systems. So and the effect of the USA, the $60 billion, which was released in April, is already starting to be felt on the front line, where you're hearing Ukrainian soldiers saying, I've never seen so many US missiles, for example.
Right. Well, that's interesting that you hear that, because the narrative over the last couple of months has been about the progress that the Russians were making in the eastern parts of Ukraine. There was great despondency on the Ukrainian side. Are you saying that that is changing now?
Yeah, I'm happy to report it seems to be. Now, we're not out of the woods yet. The failure of the US aid to come through in October last year, the failure of the Ukrainians to mobilize further in October as well, and the failure for them to dig more fortifications in some places basically handed the Russians this window of opportunity between spring and probably late summer. And we've seen them try to exploit that with their attack around Kharkiv and further attacks in the Donbass. But I think the positive news is I would have expected the Russians to do more so far, to take more advantage of that. And the Ukrainians have managed through, you know, a lot of tenacity and grit to hold on. Now, we're not out of the woods. The Russians could still do something significant between now and, let's say, the end of August. But if we don't see something significant, and so far we haven't seen the indicators yet of that, I think then we're into a more positive phase for Ukraine and a more, you know, long-term detrimental phase, especially these new sanctions which have gone on to Russian banks, etc. You know, they're going to start to bite and start at 2025. And meanwhile, US and European ammunition, especially shell production, is starting to ramp up. So I think it's Ukraine is in the point of maximum danger and hopefully starting to pass the absolute peak, the bell curve.
On the other side of the scales, then, we have the BBC extensively reporting on difficulties for the Ukrainians, Patrick, in recruiting for their army. Now, what are you hearing about that, and how much more pressure is that going to put on Ukraine as they try to push back against the Russians, despite the resources that they've been given?
Listen, I understand you read about these families where, you know, they've lost their father, they're out of marriage, and half the friends can't turn up because they're worried about getting conscripted. And I'm not Ukrainian, and I understand the complexities of, you know, this and elements of it being certainly in the East, a more like a civil war potentially than an actual state on state, i.e. that it's very complex. Land is very important in all this. Nevertheless, my personal opinion is, you know, and it would echo some of those people in the conscription offices, if these young people don't have the gumption to stand up and protect their country and essentially their families and their local communities, that price, you know, puts a lot of pressure on those that do. So we have got to a situation where the volunteers, the highly motivated, have now signed up, and a lot of them have been injured or killed. And you're looking at the next wave, and some of those young men aren't standing up. And I just find that very difficult to believe, given the nature.
I don't know,
of the
Patrick.
Threat.
I think if I was the mother of a 16 or 17 year old boy, I would be extremely reluctant to want to see them to head to a front line.
That's absolutely right. But at what price, Claire? At what price your community, the threat to your family, if the Russians come in? What is the future for your community and your family if they lose?
Well,
that's the problem.
I know, but I suppose each...
It's not all about emotions, I understand.
No,
that.
And each family and each individual will have to make a decision for themselves. But, you know, it does
but
have...
It has really... Yeah, but it's not really a decision you make for yourself. Your country has told you you're needed.
Yeah,
that's the point. You can't. It's not if we go just down the individual route, like, oh, I don't want to serve because I don't. You know, that's not how wars are won, unfortunately.
Yeah, but I mean, you do accept that it's a very difficult decision, though, for a family to face when a child is coming of age.
I think that and exemptions for if there's been casualties in the family, maybe something that they should do. I mean, there's a whole load of exemptions on this. There's a lot of people, different jobs, different medical conditions which are exempted. And I feel very, very much for the, you know, the people that are trying to avoid these squads. But look, I'm former military. I probably, you know, I'm more to one side than the other. And that's my bias. And that's fair enough. I understand other people's
point of view. No, and you're entitled to your opinion, of course. Patrick, thanks so much for your time this morning. Patrick Bury there, Senior Lecturer in Security at the University of Bath. Back after this break.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.